comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to the Kevin Smith Show. Whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this beautiful place we call Earth, thanks for being here. I'm delighted you're here, and I think you will be too. It is talk radio like nowhere else on Earth. Here at the Kevin Smith Show, well, it's the show where you matter. Couple of things that you need to know about. For those of you who are members of our members area, the K-Pods are updated. And if you like to go in and download all of last week's shows, and you know, well, there they are. So we got them updated. If you're not a member of the K Files, or if you're not a subscriber to the K Files, that's free, absolutely free. All you have to do is go to my website and subscribe. Just look for the link that says K Files. And click it, and in a few seconds you will have subscribed. You can unsubscribe anytime you want to, and we would be delighted to have you. There's no reason why you should be in the dark. You should be getting our newsletter every week. If you are not a member, now really think about this. If you're not a member, what's holding you back? Because in the members area, you get to watch the show, you get to watch the latest show, and in addition to watching the latest show, of course you can watch it live, but we have Video Galaxy where you can go in and watch some previous shows as well as other videos that we have in there. You have a library of free ebooks that you can download, and then they're yours. You have chat, you have forums, and then we do special broadcasts from time to time. And the special broadcast, generally, it's a video chat. And that's where we bring in one of our guests, and the guest turns on his web or her web camera, and then we get to chat with them, and so you get to see them while you chat. And there's a chat panel right beside the screen when we do that. So we have a lot of things that we do in the members area and a lot of things for you. And, hey, it's 23 cents a day, $6.95 a month, and we would be delighted to have you. Look, I know times are tough, and regardless of all of the rosy reports that we're hearing out of Washington and that we're hearing on the various news networks, the facts are that lots and lots and lots and lots of people are losing. They've come to the end of their unemployment benefits. They lost their jobs in this downturn, and they're coming to the end of their benefits. And then because they are no longer on the unemployment rolls, they don't get counted. And so that's, you know, it's a little bit deceptive when you hear that we have like 9 point something unemployment. It is actually, in actual fact, according to people in the know, it's higher than that, because a lot higher, because a lot of people have run out of unemployment benefits. And so I'm quite aware of the fact that there are people, lots of people, who simply can't afford to. They just can't afford 23 cents a day. If you can, and you can afford to sponsor somebody for 3 months, and you'd like to give them sort of a scholarship, send me an email. We'll work that out too. All right, we'll be back right after this, so don't go away. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening has been with us two or three times before, and it's always a pleasure to have him back with us. I've been seeing John Hoag on television quite a lot here lately on documentaries, and you probably have too. And John, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show.
Hi, Kevin. It's great to be back.
All right. Let me just make an adjustment on the audio so you can hear me better. Okay. John, you know, most of the documentaries that I've seen have had to do in some way, one fashion or another, with Nostradamus. And you are, of course, a recognized expert on Nostradamus. But that's not all you do.
No, I do many things. I am basically, it's always interesting. It's just like with what happened with Nostradamus in his own time. Most people, when they think of Nostradamus, they think of this guy who spent his whole life making prophecies up in his secret study. When in fact, that was just maybe a 3-4 year period of his life that he had many other pursuits and interests. In the same way, so do I. I am as much a watcher of future trends in collective prophetic traditions. I try to, in a lot of my other books, like Millennium Book of Prophecies and Messiahs, I try to help people break out of a certain Judeo-Christian mindset that just only sees the world and its future traditions in one prophetic style of filtering. There's actually a rich plethora of prophecies from all parts of the world. But more than that, I also had once been an opera singer. And
I didn't know that. What are you, a tenor, baritone?
I'm a baritone.
Uh-huh. I had no idea.
I've actually gone back to also being a music composer. And I'm currently working with Talia Tony Marcus, who probably any of you who watched the Jack Benny show probably remember a skit where there was this little girl who was an autograph hound who got up on the stage and interrupted Jack Benny and said, can I have your autograph? And he then writes her an autograph, and asks her to hold his violin. And while he's writing the autograph, she suddenly plays off a flourish of virtuosi trills and stuff. And that little girl is actually my music partner.
Cool. Well, you know, I had no idea. I knew about your other writings that are not specifically related to Nostradamus, but I had no idea you're a musician.
Yeah, I suppose, you know, it's funny, some people, Mangella, the director and producer of films like English Patient and Unbearable Lightness of Being, I was just reading something he was saying in his own work as a scriptwriter, producer, that I also apply to my own work in 16 books now in 19 languages, is that I write books like a person composes a symphony. It's a very musical way that I do it. Reoccurring themes, variations on the theme, and so I think some of that there's a blending of music in thinking in my work that now that I've come back full circle to composing works, I'm surprised how easy it is to convert the thoughts in words into notes.
Well, you know, I had no idea that we would even discuss this tonight, but that's one of the things that I talk about, is that I think one of the worst things that ever happened to the world of education is John Dewey, because John Dewey segregated every subject from every other subject. So if you're studying biology, you just study biology. And if you're studying history, you just study history. If you study music, you study only music. And the problem with that is that there's so much history that goes with science and so much science that goes with music, and so much music that goes with history. One of the biggest riots that ever happened in Havana, Cuba, happened when Igor Stravinsky presented his symphony Rite of Spring. So that's a historical event that was caused by Stravinsky. And my view is that education is a unified field.
Well, it should be. It should be, because education is one of the keynotes or cornerstones to what either gives us a positive future or a negative future, because it is education, and or the miseducation, it's the Deweyizing and particularizing of the liberal arts, the sciences, and all of these things into little separate parts, which is just another step in the whole egoic evolution of what many mystical teachings tell us are human beings getting deeper and deeper into this illusion of being separate from the whole, from the universal. And the Dewey system of itemizing things is just one of those ways in which we lose a sense of wholeness, and then therefore lose an ability to seek harmony between polar opposites, turning them rather than polarization but into complementaries, dancers in the dance. And we're now in a position in the 21st century where this system of de-education, this roboticization of people, is reached a point where we're becoming so predictable that we may not have a future after this century unless we have a revolution in education that somehow helps the soul coming into this world to retain a memory of itself and not become the tools of identity. I mean, to put it in a simple terms, the education system brings in people born into this mortal coil, and in 20 years' time or so makes them believe that they're the car rather than the driver of their car, their body-mind, through the destiny of their lives. It's like we're taught to think we're the hammer rather than the hand holding it and using it. And there needs to be a revolution that will change the way we bring new beings into this world and not doom them to repeat by our seeding the repetitious past that human beings could survive up until this current new challenge of being in a global society. Now everything we do is affecting everybody around the world.
Well, I agree with that, and I think what has happened under the Dewey system of education is education has come to be all about knowing stuff rather than learning to be.
Yeah.
And being has to be more important than knowing, because knowing makes no difference unless there is being. This may sound a little deep for some folks, but let's think about this. All of the knowledge in the world, if you could put it in one library and then you lock the doors, you have all the knowledge in the world. You have it. You possess it. But unless there are beings, unless there are people being something that can use that knowledge is useless. And the same is true in our lives. You have to be something, and then as the being, know something, and now you're useful. Now at this point, you are the hand with a hammer, And I think that's a great example you used. We've been taught to think that we're the hammer instead of the hand holding the hammer. And I think that's exactly right. You've done some work. I've seen you talking on television on some documentaries about 2012, and you've done some work, some research and some thinking along those lines that are not Nostradamic. Let's get into that a little bit. Where are we headed, John?
Well, you know, on HokeProphecy.com, I've been doing a 7-part series, basically trying to answer that question to a lot of my readers who have watched documentaries like Nostradamus 2012, which was just rebroadcast again this weekend with the next Nostradamus. It's two documentaries I did in 2008 and 2009. And people watch those and are saying, yeah, what's really going on? Because it seems like these documentaries, you see a little bit of you, a little bit of somebody else, and it's all generally talking about a very terrifying future, and then there's a little platitude at the end that we have choice and we can change things around the last minute if we want to. And then you have all these people who seem to sound like they know what they're talking about, who are telling you all these wonderful stories about how Nostradamus indicated this and said that and wanted to say this about 2012, that 2012 was such an important date that Mayan calendar cycle changing of their 5,000-year history cycle, rebooting in 2012 was somehow going to invoke a galactic beam when the sun aligns with the galactic center on the winter solstice of 2012. And, you know, it's interesting because I remember when I was in the Inner Sanctum of the Masonic Lodge in San Antonio being filmed for about 4 hours for that show, as usual, and you know, I've done over 100 of these since 1987 in three continents, TV shows. I've kind of probably been dealing with the media more than any other Nostradamus expert in history. And in that, I'm constantly trying to advise the people who bring me into these shows to not make the same mistakes the previous shows have done, and that is think that human beings that are watching this aren't intelligent enough to get a little more background and a little more balanced examination of whether 2012 is actually just BS or is it really something of significance, or does it really, the truth really lie somewhere in between the two? And I gave them hours of material, and they asked me questions, as many of these documentaries do, about what I think about what Nostradamus says about 2012. And if you notice on that show, although you see me on kind of making almost like prophetic punchlines here and there in the way they edited it, you don't actually see me sitting there say, well, Nostradamus said about 2012 this and that, like all the other people. Because when they asked me about that, I said, in my 30 years of studying Nostradamus's Renaissance French and his use of Latin and other languages in his unique, random, dyslexic coding of his prophecies, there is not anything that I can stretch, even to the extreme, that would indicate that he thought anything was important about the year 2012. And rather than have me be that sympathetic but contrarian person on the show, most of the time the TV execs just cut that stuff out. Or they just cut stuff out like what we were just talking about, which is stuff I've also tried to put into every documentary, the issue of how prophecy ticks, how the engine of our repetitious history replaying bad futures, how that works, and if you know how it works, you can stop it from happening. You know, that's always, I'm always told, oh, people won't understand that, and you know, and I don't know, maybe they're right.
I don't think so. I think people can understand that. And especially, you know, we were talking about folks in the Judeo-Christian stream of thought. I think they can understand that. And the reason is because in their own book, they have a story of a prophet who gave a message. And this message was, if you people don't repent, the whole place is going to be destroyed. God is going to destroy the whole town. Now, this is the story of Nineveh, yeah. And of course, then you know that's the story of the prophet being thrown overboard and, off the ship, and a whale swallowed him, and then he was deposited on the shore, and he goes to Nineveh. He didn't want to go there because he thought the people would be better off dead. He didn't like them. But he went, and he delivered his message, and in that story, now this is within the pages of the book that both Jews and Christians call their holy book, the Bible. The prophecy is given, and the people do change their ways, and the destruction does not come. So they had a choice of two ways to go and two possible outcomes. And so I think those folks, the Judeo-Christian folks, if they read their book, I think they can understand that prophecy ticks that way.
Well, you see, I need to qualify what I said about maybe they're right. I'm saying that as long as, because I've told that story and seen that story on the editor's floor, cutting room floor, many times. The thing that people need to understand is that the business of entertainment, which is now dominating nonfiction documentaries as well as the news, have it in their mind that the best way to compete and get advertisement and have ratings is to be sensational. To an extent that I've lived almost 55 years now, and I've lived long enough to see how documentarian work has also become another MTV reality show in a lot of ways. And so what that's creating is, over a few generations' time, is a what I call, rather than people listening to this show can read the Bible and understand that thing, that story of Nineveh. But the mass media out there is actually creating a climate in the world where people are starting to think that what the mob psychology dispensed is the truth. And so this is one of those big lurking challenges and dangers.
All right, we have to step away for a break, John. And we'll be back in just a couple of minutes. Folks, don't go away. More with John Hoag, one of America's most famous prophets. Welcome back to the show. My guest is John Hoag. John, I had to cut you off in mid-sentence, but you were talking to us about that a lot of the documentaries we see really focus more on entertainment value and sensationalism rather than all of the information.
Yes, and it's creating over... I've done this since 87, I've watched a continuing deepening of this idea that the authority of the television is, for a lot of people, less and less questioned. I mean, what stimulated this seven-part series at HoagProphecy.com was a person who was 28 years old, was in college, so was already in higher learning, and yet her response in the letter to what she was seeing on that show, she basically was freaked out watching the show, thinking that the world was going to come to an end in 2012. And what's intriguing is, to me, is that the person, and I get this a lot with a lot of readers, is they see a few seconds of a soundbite and think that that is the whole and entire concept or theory of a person or of a life's work. In a way, you could call it a deifying, using the Dewey system of thinking to itemize even further, not just one specialty from another, but one point from all the rest. I mean, about the only thing I said on that documentary about 2012 was that 2012 is probably not the end, but the beginning of a whole process of interesting things, upheavals, and that are coming. And then, of course, they cut the rest of what I said off and said where I went on to say that we're actually in a century of transformation and upheaval coming, and that in a few short years after 2012, people won't even remember it as anything more than 100th of the 100 years of transformation that are coming. But you see, that gets cut out. And what I hope to do, because I also get another set of questions, and people say, well, Mr. Hoag, if they're continually skewering what you're saying, why do you keep going on the shows? Why don't you just, as protest, silence yourself off these shows? And the first answer I give is that that's ineffective. For one thing, enough of what I say on the shows, even if it's just my presence, is enough to make a person sense that maybe there's something more going on than what's meeting the eye in the soundbite, then they'll come to HoagProphecy.com or they'll go read one of my books and find out that there's actually a whole lot more going on than meets the television boob tube eye. So I've made a decision to constantly be on these shows and hopefully get a message through, and sometimes we do. I strongly invite anyone to watch something that was done back in 2006 called The Other Nostradamus, which also History Channel did, where they tried to make a comparison about the American sleeping prophet of the 20th century, Edgar Cayce, with Nostradamus, to see if there were similarities between the 16th century French prophet and the sleeping prophet from Virginia Beach. And that was a very good documentary. They didn't try to overstuff it with all kinds of stuff. They just, if they had main points to do, they showed the opposing and supporting ideas, and at the same time had great graphics and excitement, but also gave people a background to everything that was happening in these quotes between Nostradamus and Edgar Cayce. And so every once in a while I get on a documentary and my suggestions are heeded. Often what happens too is that my suggestions are more than understood by the film producers and directors and writers, but then in the final cut, when it gets up to the executives at the top, they often, in many TV companies, pontificate their usual, well, people aren't that smart, you gotta dumb it down. Danger of that in review is that if that keeps going, and if the people don't start complaining and writing to these people and showing them that that is not true, then this myth of dumbing it down will, in another generation or two, reach a point where it can threaten the collapse of civilization. Because it's one of the biggest threats that comes in for prophecies, warnings that can be avoided. Even Nostradamus, in his commentaries about our time, said, oh, what a loss of learning and letters there will be at that time. And then he describes weather conditions, events, upheavals that sound very contemporary to our times.
Well, what you're describing reminded me of what happens each year at Halloween all over the country, and I guess in other countries. There are these, and I'll do it in quotes, haunted houses, where everything is, you know, it's all special effects and it's all designed to scare you and give you a thrill. And you know, going into it, you pay to go in, and it's like an amusement park, but no rides. It's just, you know, you walk through a haunted house with all kinds of ghouls and goblins and ghosts and monsters and frightful sights. Now, you know, going in, that's not real stuff. But, you know, we're sort of getting to the point where we've lost the understanding that that monster really is there. It's just really not a monster. So, you know, the date, December the 21st, 2012, really is there in that Mayan calendar. And but it just may not really be the monster people think it is. And, you know, it may be that what's happened is some of the people that have studied it and read about it have put some makeup on it, dressed it up, and made it a bit more horrific than it was ever intended. And that's my view. I think that is what's happened. I don't think that's going to be a particularly significant date. But I could be wrong, and there are many people in my audience who think it will be a significant date. I don't think it will be.
The thing is that what will probably give 2012 more significance for a lot of people than the turning of the millennium is that it seems like all the things that people were anticipating, natural disasters, swarms of earthquakes, you know, the largest disruption of air traffic in history, all these kind of apocalyptic-looking things seem to be swarming more around the years preceding 2012 than they were in the late 1990s. 2000 passed rather peacefully compared to the last few years. And that kind of brings up some ideas. People then will think, well, maybe because the Mayans were such a mathematically ingenious ancient peoples, maybe their clock of the big age change is more accurate to the time when things really change. And more mainstream prophetic traditions are off by 12 years or so. So I imagine in some ways that will be used to emphasize apocalyptic thinking even more in the next few years. However, if people step back from this and actually stop just hearing from people who can't even speak Maya, who are not even archaeologists who have lived with the Maya, they will find that the Maya, the people really inducted into the mystery of this, do not see 2012 as an age-ending year. It's just simply when the count of the what has been incorrectly called the Bakhtun, the 13th Bakhtun, that's modern Maya. If you study the archaeology of it, the term should be called peak, not Batun. This cycle is definitely in harmony with a lot of other prophetic cycles, give or take a few decades, that see a great rebooting happening in our lifetimes. And I stress, a 70-year period. And Mayan mystics who have not been kind of persuaded by what I call the gringo experts from the north to look at it in a New Age expanded way, but just simply as the message was told, it's simply in their own books of prophecy, like the Popol Vuh, there's not any specific reference to 2012 or that passage of that date in Maya as anything significant. Just as what you find out if you actually study the meat and potatoes of the actual prophecies that we have in our hands from the Maya, they actually parallel a lot of what was said by the Hopi, a lot of what is said by over 500 tribes and their prophetic traditions in North America. Native Americans generally share a lot of similar prophecies with slight derivations, but really quite remarkable how all these different nations share a similar view of the future. In that view, around this time is a period where the world goes into crisis and then is kind of reshaped. But they've not, this is a longer process than what people fixating on the straight and narrow 2012 myth are willing to hear. So it's 2012, like 2010, like 2011, like 2013, 2014, 15, 16, and all the 2020s are going to be very interesting periods. And if Nostradamus says absolutely nothing about 2012, he does make astrological predictions that say a lot about 2008 and 2009. His 2012 was the year 1999. He thought that was the big shift in history towards the end of the seventh millennium, he called it. And he has a lot to say if his astrology is accurate to this. The configurations that are coming in the 2020s makes it, in general, a far more significant period of time for human upheaval, natural disasters, and and ultimately a maturing of the human race through the gauntlet of fiery times into a new age. It's the 2020s, which I've called in my books the Roaring 2020s, that seem to be more of his interest than anything dealing with the 20-teens, which 2012 is just the beginning of.
All right, well, now you said that he points to 1999 as being when there's a great shift into sort of a new age, or maybe I'm using the wrong word. Tell us about that. Why 1999, and did he get it right?
Well, it's interesting. 1999, he keeps talking about there's two basic prophecies. There is one where he describes a great eclipse at the time of the grand millennium, which would be around 2000, that will cast a shadow on the place where Jesus was crucified, as well as Flanders Field in Belgium. Now, that's a clue to where the shadow of the eclipse would happen. There has been only one eclipse that did, a grand eclipse even, that did that. That was in August 11th, 1999. He said that this would be an important portent to a time of upheavals, of earthquakes, natural disasters that would begin to launch this period of apocalyptic time.
All right, we'll pick up there when we come back. We have to step away for a break for just a moment. We'll be back, folks, with John Hogue right after this. Back, and we are talking with John Hogue this evening. John Hogue is a well-known expert on Nostradamus, as well as an expert on prophecy in his own right. And we were talking about 1999 and the fact that this eclipse took place. What's the significance of this eclipse?
Well, in the eclipse, it's supposed to presage the coming period of either 25 or 27 years of upheavals and natural disasters and seismic activity that is not only literal in as in earth changes, but also seismic in earthquakes in religious thinking, earthquakes in social and economic ideas. You know, Nostradamus is a poet, so one has to think in a poetic mind when working with his prophecies, but at the same time have enough balance to make sure one's understanding of the 16th century French is right, and not projecting some modern conceit onto them, which often happens. Or the other thing, too, is that Nostradamus' prophecies are often encoded and obscure and nebulous in an attempt not to say too much so that people like Adolf Hitler and others wouldn't recognize themselves in the prophecies. Actually, Adolf Hitler used the prophecies of Nostradamus through Goebbels, his propaganda minister, because of the reference to a person named Hister, who's the captain of Greater Germany, were used against the French and the English in the early stages of World War II. Then Winston Churchill had his own bank of astrologers weave and create leaflets that they shot over to the German lines and dropped in bomb bay doors out to German cities, predicting how Nostradamus foresaw the end of the Third Reich. Finally, when America came into it, MGM started making these little black and white film shorts saying Nostradamus says it's so. And it is because of the triggering of bad people seeing themselves in the prophecies that, ironically, Nostradamus became a world-famous prophet because of this propaganda war that was going on between all the sides of World War II, trying to use him. in most cases, making fraudulent prophecies. The irony is that the only group of the three that actually used the real prophecies and were sincerely trying to find an answer to their future, ironically, were the Nazis. The people in the white hats, the people who won the war, actually, in Nostradamus' name, created completely fraudulent prophecies. But be that as it may, the significance of 1999 is that wherever the shadow of that great eclipse passed, there would be a great earthquake shortly after. It's interesting to note that after the shadow passed over Flanders and then went over Greece and Turkey and down into the Middle East in Jerusalem, eventually all the way across Iran to Gujarat before the shadow left the earth's limb, all those places in the next year and a half, most of those places, Turkey, Greece, Gujarat, Iran, suffered massive earthquakes. The case in point, a few weeks after in August, a little later in August into September, Greece around Corinth suffered a major earthquake, followed shortly after by a major earthquake in Turkey that killed about 50,000 people on the Ankaran fault line. There was some quakes in Iran, and then finally, actually just a few days before I flew to India in January of 2001, Gujarat was leveled. The state of Gujarat was leveled by a very serious quake near Kutch and Ahmedabad and that area. I remember flying over it and noticing that all the lights were out, you know, kind of ominous, especially with the fact that many years later, in 2009, something that I think is rather unique and rare in the shadows of eclipses, we had, you know, in July, in mid-July, what was called the Grand Eclipse of 2009. And that eclipse had, because the moon was at a close passage to the Earth, there were some areas where people would have the sun in shadow for 8 minutes. So it's not going to happen again until, I think, the 22nd or 23rd century. I think it's the 22nd century that's going to happen again, around 2134 or something. So it's very rare. We'll never see an eclipse quite like that. It passed over India, China, the Samoa, the shadow left the earth around Samoa, passed over the Okinawa, Shanghai, Bhutan, Burma, and India. What's intrigued me about this, this passage is that the shadow began exactly where the last shadow from the 1999 eclipse ended. In Gujarat. It's almost like part two of the same shadow. And again, with this eclipse, there were large-scale quakes in Bhutan, in Burma. The quake that caused the tidal waves, the tsunamis in Samoa, that happened. So, I would think, and I theorize, and hopefully I'm wrong, but I theorize that oftentimes when Nostradamus was looking at the future, it seemed like he got confused with things that were similar and then predicted them as the same thing. And his great eclipse, which he saw in 1999, which he accurately predicted where the shadow would go, may actually have been mistaken for two eclipses and not one, and so this prophecy is still on. And in the next, year or so, we're still in a window of danger of some major natural catastrophes in China, India, and also economic upheavals involved in these things. So that's where 1999 comes in indirectly. Directly, it comes in the verse, the four-line quatrain 72 of Century 10, when he describes in the year 1999 and seventh month, The great king of terror will descend from the skies. He will resurrect the king of the Mongols. Before and after, Mars rules happily. Now, this is code, some of that. 1999 and seventh month can be interpreted two ways. It can mean the seventh month of the year, as we understand that, that would be July. But also, if you look at it can also mean 1999 plus 7 months. So it could mean 2000 July, in the year 2000, closer to the millennium. It can also mean a third thing, because the word he uses in French for seventh month is septmois. Septmois, if one, it's very important to study the classics, because that was a passion of Nostradamus, and like many Renaissance learned people, he loved to pun and get wax metaphorical in Hellenistic and classical Roman ideas.
John, I think I know where you're headed. But we have a break that's upon us, and so we're going to get all of the rest of this when we come back from the break. Let me just ask you, I hate to interrupt you like that, but let me ask you this. When he says septemois, is that the normal form of the word that you would use?
It is the original term for September, because September is before the Julian month of July and the Augustus month of August were added to the calendar. September was where July is today.
I see. September would have been the seventh month, but it's also September.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. We're going to grab the rest of that when we come back from this break, folks. My guest is John Hogue, and when we come back from this break, we'll talk to him a little bit more, and then we'll open the telephone lines for you, so don't go away. Back. We're talking with John Hogue, and for those of you joining us just now in this second hour, welcome aboard. I'm glad you're here, and wish you had heard that first hour. You will kick yourself for not hearing the first hour, but we're glad you're here now. And John, you were talking to us about 1999 and the seventh month.
Yes, this is in regards to what Nostradamus really considered his 2012, his date or year of significant shift in the axis of the future destiny of humanity, if you will. And, you know, towards the last of the hour, part of the hour, just a quick review, we were looking at two prophecies, one of them describing a pattern of shadowing over the earth from the eclipse that would happen at the end of the seventh millennium, which is his way of saying year 2000, that would be a portent for the beginning of a lot of the upheavals that are kind of over top and upend the status quo of the world in politics, ecology, everything, basically create apocalyptic, i.e. revelatory times, that would last 25 to 27 years. So the first thing was that, and we talked about how the shadow described that in the prophecies was actually visited the countries that were under the shadow of the eclipse of August 11th, 1999, which is what he was describing, did see major earthquakes in Greece, Turkey, and finally Gujarat. Then we moved on to the second reference to 1999, which is more upfront and abrupt, where in quatrain 72 of Century 10, 10th volume of his magnum opus, The Prophecies, Les Prophéties, he basically says, in 1999 and 7 months, the great king of terror will descend from the skies. He shall resurrect the king of the Mongols before and after Mars rules happily. So we were looking at, if the seventh month is July, then something should have happened in July 1999 that it was of such significance. Well, nothing happened. Then the other way to look at it is it's 1999 plus 7 months, which means July 2000 was supposed to be the significant event. That's another possibility. Well, nothing happened. Then, if one then looks at the fact that the word used for seventh month is the root word in Renaissance French, and French in general, for septembre, septmoire, it means that the seventh month, Nostradamus is following something which is always a good thing to follow in studying him, is follow the classical metaphors. Nostradamus was a man of his day, and a learned man of his day loved to pun and loved to wax metaphoric in classical Greek and Roman ways. He used classical and Greek Roman names. For instance, when he wanted to describe Hitler, he used the Roman, ancient Roman name for the River Danube, where Hitler was born. That was called the Hister. When he wanted to talk about Russia and some great thing happening that would cause the law of more, a communal sharing of everything, which is how he called communism, he said this would fail, and it would first begin happening in the region of the Borysthenes. The Borysthenes was the ancient Roman name for the Dnieper River. And of course, Chernobyl was the nuclear disaster that finally gave Gorbachev, the premier of Soviet Union at that time, the political clout to really start his perestroika, his opening up of the Soviet Union, which precipitated in a few short years the fall of the law of more, i.e. all things shared in common communally, communism. So these things happen, and so when you look at septuagint, one has to think like a Roman, ancient Roman again, and realize that septembre is, it used to be the month that July is now, because the Romans expanded their calendar when Julius Caesar added July as the new seventh month, and then his cousin Octavian, when he became Caesar Augustus, created August. That's where you get August. So, poor little seventh month, septembre, becomes the ninth month. So, nothing happened in September, in the seventh month of 2000 or 1999. But, something very significant that sounds a little more like the prophecy did happen in September of 2001. A great king of terror, the word Le Roi Effrayeur. Effrayeur is a word link that comes in about five different prophecies, which describes the king of terror as Nostradamus's third and final Antichrist. And I wrote a whole book about that called Nostradamus and the Antichrist, codenamed Mabus, which is an e-book that can be seen at hokeprophecy.com. And in that, I gather those verses scattered throughout Nostradamus that seem to link a larger vision about a Middle Eastern area of either the theater of the Antichrist or the origin spot geographically of the Antichrist, that talks about terror as a weapon, piracy, and of course there again Nostradamus would use what he knew in his own time to make his metaphors. When he lived, Islamic pirates used to hijack ships. They were the Barbary Corsairs, working in consort with the Ottoman Empire, which was actually threatening Christendom quite severely in the 1650s, with Suleiman the Magnificent knocking on the doors of Vienna a few years after Nostradamus wrote his prophecies. And the corsairs were actually raiding the coasts of Provence where Nostradamus lived. So his kind of terrorism in the 16th century seems to be applying to a future terrorist leader coming out of the skies. Now, there are another set of prophecies talking about terror, that's the link, coming out of the skies at latitude 45 degrees to set a huge fire explosion over the new city, a great new city. Now, gotta remember that they didn't have longitudes in Nostradamus' day. They had very inaccurate latitudes on their maps. Most people know today that New York City is, which certainly was a, you have to look for cities that did not exist in Nostradamus' time if they are great and new, and they have to be large cities, and they have to be around latitude 45. Now, the closest hit on that of a city that didn't exist when Nostradamus lived is New York City. It's also half the name, New, Nouveau, in French. The latitudes were often off several degrees, and if Nostradamus, after having his vision, was induced to look at his maps, because he was very much into geography and maps, he would probably be looking at a map that had the wrong coordinates, because there's no longitude to help you out. And so I think it's close enough to New York City. It's off by a couple of degrees, but it's close enough, especially because the link to this terror has a very interesting thing it does back to that 1999 prophecy. If Septmois is nudging us to look a little closer at 1999, perhaps it's telling us that it's also in code, and to reverse the 1999 to 9111, Septmois, September month. Then it actually spells out the September 11th date. The great king of terror descending from the skies is the same king of terror he's alluding to who attacks the new city, who in another prophecy is the one who attacks via the flying over the garden of the world. The great new city is attacked. The hollow mountains shall be seized and plunged into a boiling cauldron of their own debris, smoke, and field. And then we plunged into the tub. That, by the way, is the name given to the 8-floor-deep, watertight basement compartment on which the World Trade Center towers were built. It was called the tub by the architects. Cuvée. Cuvée in Old French not only means literally a tub, but a tub where you throw in the things that you need, the elements to create preservatives, potions, and also it's an alchemist's pot. Mm-hmm. And one has to imagine that Nostradamus is visualizing the boiling and of clouds and things as he pushed things in to create his medicines and other things, was a metaphoric comparison to the boiling clouds of the falling towers of 911. So that brings us in 1999 to the era of the third and final Antichrist, the first being called Nepalanoir, a play on Apollyon from the Book of Revelation, the Angel of the Abyss, who also sounds like Napoleon. And the rest of the prophecies about him describe in many of the details that relate only to Napoleon Bonaparte, who Nostradamus thought, this emperor of the French, was the first Antichrist. The second was Hitler, the captain of Greater Germany, which, by the way, is the official name of the Third Reich, Gross Deutschland in German, Greater Germany. And he said about that great treaties and unions would be broken in the years 37, 41, and 45. Very interesting, because that was a pattern in the 16th century that you didn't actually mention the first two digits of a year. You just would mention the year's last two digits. Now, if you go and search throughout the last 500 years of history, you will not find major treaties in a sequence of those three numbers failing any other time but 1937, 1941, and 1945. So,
well, that's rather specific stuff, isn't it?
It is. It's a strange thing that Nostradamus felt, and he admitted it in his writings. He was compelled to make a conscious choice that he was going to write these prophecies, he was going to obscure them. And he says in his own convoluted way that it would probably earn him forever the stamp of a charlatan, but that it was necessary, that he didn't want to ruffle the fragile sensitivities of people who couldn't see the changes in the future that would be so vastly changing their religious ideas, their social ideas and hopes and fears. He basically didn't want them to damn their own future. And you've got to also understand that his immediate audience and the immediate motivation for his writing these prophecies was a very clear and present danger he saw astrologically for a religious civil war between Protestants and Catholics in his own country. Nostradamus the Catholic was afraid that this vision of the king dying. And he says very clearly in one of his prophecies, it's a prophecy that we all know about, the famous field of combat. Anybody who studied Nostradamus usually hears about the famous story of Henry II being warned by Nostradamus several years before not to partake in jousting tournaments. And he did, and he died pretty much the way Quatrain 35 of Century 1 said he would. But what is not addressed a lot in TV or other things is more specific prophecies that were also written at that time saying when France has a one-eyed king, and he describes what goes on, and France has only had a one-eyed king once, and that was in 1559 when Henry II lost his eye from a jousting stick. The stick plunged into his brain, and he died of peritonitis 10 days later. There, you know, these in all of this foggy, open to interpretive verses, which indeed there many of them are, if one thinks like Nostradamus, reads the things Nostradamus read, waxes poetic in the classical metaphors of the time, you will find some very interesting things get unlocked to look at. And certain ideas that absolutely are objective, for instance, like saying in 1556 that the Ottoman Empire and the Persian Empire would stop their wars, make a treaty, certain lands would be passed along in the year of October 1727. Well, that happened in 1727, and you could even say, well, you know, maybe they heard about that and were somehow influenced. Of course, information was not so easily attained in those days, but this was a region that was anti-Christendom, that was not at all connected to anything Nostradamus was writing, because in Sharia law, making prophecies is a sin of the infidels. You would be beheaded for doing that in the Islamic world at that time. So nobody was reading Nostradamus. And this thing did happen, these lands were passed, and he wrote that in 1556, about October 1527.
All right, tell you what I'd like to do. I would like to open up the telephone lines and invite our audience, if they have a question for you or a comment regarding what we're talking about here tonight, we want to open up the phone lines where they can give us a call. And, folks, the telephone lines are open. The telephone number, the main number, is 623-444-5889. And you can call that number from anywhere in the world. And if you are in the USA or if you're in Canada and you need to use the toll-free number, you can do so. It is 888-223-4599. If you're outside of the USA and outside of Canada, you can call us on that main number, 623-444-5889, or because I do not have an international toll-free number, you can send me a flash message. if you're outside the USA and you're outside of Canada. And you do that by going to my website. Scroll down. You'll see the link that says Flash Message. All right, let's go to the telephone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, it's Kevin from North Bay, Ontario.
Hello, Kevin.
Hello. Hello there, John, and hello there, Kevin.
Hello, Kevin.
Yes, yeah, very fascinating show here tonight. I wanted to know, a lot of these prophets, not only Nostradamus, but also other ones from biblical times and whatnot, these people had an amazing keen knowledge of a science called precession of the equinoxes, astronomical things. Is it possible that these people figure that something happens to our planet and our solar system on a cyclical basis, based on this precessional clock, that maybe it's not really a prophecy at all, really, but the fact that these people have been able to read these ancient documents and say, you know what, after so long, perhaps maybe every half precessional cycle, like when our planet goes through half a year, that these different seasonal changes have a traumatic effect on the certain area of the planet, that on a galactic scale it's the same thing when we go through the great year, that halfway through we get like 12,000 some years, that we go through some sort of a traumatic shift in a quote-unquote season, and that it really shakes up the planet really badly. Is there anything that to suggest that these quote-unquote prophets may have actually been able to read this ancient knowledge and be able to perhaps give a warning to future generations that this stuff has happened before and that it's going to happen again?
Nostradamus used astrology, the mundane astrologer, which is a political astrologer. That means a person who uses the same techniques to read the stars, to read nations, the birth of nations, by reading the futures of kings, if they're monarchies, and whatnot. And there is very clearly in his writings an instance of that there are patterns, that there are seasons to history, that there are a number of prophetic traditions, the 500 Celtic year cycle. Well, to give you an example of even things less mundane than a change in eras and cultures, you'll notice that every 500 years, communications on the planet go through a jump. After 1000 AD, we'll go back a couple 500 year cycles, you could go back to the 500 AD, that's when communications kind of broke down into the Dark Age. You follow that 500 years later, you have the Dark Ages somewhat ending because of the Crusades bringing Western men out of the Dark Ages into the Muslim world, where they then took that information, increased understanding of mathematics and other things, that was really the spark, the seed that planted the Renaissance, which happened 500 years ago, where we got the Gutenberg printing press, which suddenly made this huge leap in communications from handwritten monk books to the printed press, which gave the vernacular language to even people being able to read the Bible or their scriptures in their own language. And this was a huge revolution that Nostradamus was a part of. 500 years later, you have the Internet. And just a few weeks ago, the next Gutenberg phenomenon, Steve Jobs' iPad. You know, finally a little tablet that we're finally now getting to a point where a delivery system, which is as light or lighter as a book, which also is freed of a lot of the linear thinking of a book, will now revolutionize writing and multimedia work and interconnectivity. So that's just one of many things you can look at in the seasons of history. And the precession of the equinox is one of the oldest prophetic traditions. It comes from Sumeria, when astrology was created. And it was back then in those ziggurats of mud brick in those ancient times that people became aware of the tropical zodiac, the constellations in which the sun passes roughly a degree every 71 to 72 years. The vernal equinox precedes itself to another position slightly every year. And it's one of the reasons why we have to sometimes update our calendars, as did happen with the Julian calendar becoming Gregorian. which was, by the way, predicted by Nostradamus. And after a while, if you don't change the precession change, you will have summer in December, and eventually, or things like that. It takes a long time. It takes nearly 26,000 years for the vernal equinox position of the sun to precede itself all the way around the 12 zodiac constellations. So there's a pattern in time that you can also break down as that's the great cosmic year. Now, certain cultures have broken this down.
John, hang on just a second. We have a break coming up in a couple of minutes. And, caller, if you'll just hang in there, we'll get to you in just a moment. All right, John, go ahead.
Yes. So you can break it down into 5,000-year cycles, as the Maya do in their calendar. You can break it down into the Buddhist 25-century cycle, the Wheel of Dharma, it's called. That means that every 25 centuries, every 2,500 years, a great world teacher comes to spin the wheel of religious understanding anew and bring fresh ideas into the evolution of consciousness. That's another cycle. You have, actually in 2008, you have a situation with the cosmic year that we are now in between two cosmic months. If it's a 12-month system, then each month, in the cosmic sense, takes a normal 2,150 years or so for the vernal equinox to pass through the sign. That's why we have the age of Pisces. That's actually the month.
All right, the break is upon us. Caller, if you'll hang on, after we come back from the break, we'll get you up. And we'll be back, folks, right after this. Welcome back, and my guest this evening is John Hoag. John, we have a caller that has been holding for 8 minutes, so we're going to take the call. Caller, you are finally live on the Kevin Smith Show. If you'll tell us your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, this is Trey from Louisiana.
Trey, it's been years since I've heard from you.
Yeah, it's been about a year, Kevin, and you have a great guest tonight, and I'm glad to see you're still alive and well, and got the show still going. I see the little monitor there. So anyway, hopefully good luck with it. Continued every month and to keep that going. Thank you for clearing up that old Hitler thing. You know, we always thought it was misspelled Hitler, or he was afraid to spell the name right because he might get killed by the guy or something. And that's actually correctly spelled word. I wanted to ask you two questions. One of them is one quick one. It's Are you going to be involved in any more Nostradamus effects episodes? Do you know if that series is going to continue? And let me ask you this: so I always wanted to ask an expert that has been studying Nostradamus. Do you think what he was doing then is what we now call remote viewing, or do you think he was doing something totally different?
No, actually, Trey, it was remote viewing. No prophet I've ever encountered has put so many geographic locations in his prophecies. And if you make a map of every reference, with over 654 geographic references, you will see that right around his town of Salon-en-Provence, or Salon-en-Crawl was what it's called back then, in Provence, you see it's almost black with areas notated of his local corner of the world. And as you go farther and farther out from where he was making the prophecies, the geographic locations become less and less, until in the case of the Western Hemisphere, he only mentions it seven times. Asia, Far East, once. And so definitely there's a feeling of remote viewing, in what we call today remote viewing, and there's something else. In my biography, Nostradamus, A Life and Myth, which you can get at hoagprophecy.com, there is a clear indication that Nostradamus, in his own confessions about his magical practices, was a medium of astral entities. he called them angelic entities, and he was actually following a tradition that came from Egypt, Assyria, Chaldean regions, and Greece with the Delphic oracles. We know this because he actually quotes outright long passages of Iamblichus's Mysteries Egyptorum, which is was the Bible of Theurgus. Those are people who conjure divine spirits. That's what they would call it in those days. What people would say today is a channeler. And so the vast majority of his work was done channeling what he thought to be other beings discarnated. So, you know, it's one of the masks, media masks of Nostradamus, is that they've latched onto the idea of poor old Nostradamus in his civilian street clothes staring into a bowl of water. He did do hydromancy, but it was a minor discipline. He mostly conjured up spirits in his secret study, dressed in a white hooded robe. So not in his 16th century laces and three-cornered hat and all of that you see in these TV shows. Now, I've said that in every show. I said, please dress him properly or see him going through the purification process before he turns himself into a Neoplatonist necromancer. But, you know, one of these days, I keep trying, I'm stubborn, one of these days, one of these shows is actually going to do that. And then you'll really get to see how Nostradamus did his magic. So that's the first question. The series, Nostradamus Effect, I was down in Mexico City in front of about 20 journalists across Latin America when it was released in January in the Spanish language. It was a highly successful series. Certainly it has a lot of the sensationalism and entertainment values that sometimes sacrifice good documentarian work. But I will commend that group for allowing me to say what I really think about 2012 from 30 years of scholarship and what I really think about the lost book of Nostradamus, which is, in my opinion, after studying it, a fraud. So, and that book is the basis for a lot of those people who like to tie Nostradamus into 2012. But the book was not created before 1700. Nostradamus died in 1566. His son, who might have created the book, died in 1629. And so this book is probably one of the many knockoffs that were created by people. Even in Nostradamus' time, people were writing prophecies in his name. He even got arrested in Marseille for someone else writing his name on prophecies that were against the king. So that's been going on, and was in his lifetime and after. So I don't know if the series is going to have a second season. I'm pretty sure they will, and I'd certainly be very interested in being involved with them.
All right, caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yes, good evening, gentlemen. It's Terry from Ohio.
Hello, Terry.
Hi.
Hello, Terry.
I got a couple of questions for you, John. The first one, the Bible code, you know, they say that they can get quatres or meaning out of, like, Moby Dick, if you look hard enough out of every book. And say, given enough time, you're going to have an aha moment with Nostradamus, you know, and be able to twist things around and say, you know, oh, here it is, finally happened, you know, we just missed it, you know.
Well, here's the thing, because just so I can move it through for... I get your train of thought, and I tell you, what doesn't get stated enough is there have been many people over the centuries who documented interpretations, not in hindsight, so everybody's a great prophet in hindsight. Many people have used prophecies of Nostradamus and documented, written, and published their findings, and then the things did happen. It wasn't one of those, oh, well, if we keep trying to twist this poor 16th century French word enough times, we can get anything out of it. So that's certainly one way that doesn't happen. The other thing, too, is with the Bible code. It's true, if you use the law of chance and if you continually change the sequence of the numbers that each word represent, and if you keep changing them enough times, you will randomly find things that sound like predictions. So I'm a bit of a skeptic about the Bible Code. I have not seen yet, and certainly not seen documented before events, things that would prove to me that this is not something falling under the often seemingly miraculous world of chance. But
They usually say they can't find something until after it happens.
That is pathetic. Let me just say, Trey, that's just coming out recently, and I am going to nail that very hard when I meet these people in panels and stuff, because that is a cop out, and it's a cop out from people who know they're running a system that's not working, and they're trying to make rationales for it. But with that said, there are things in the prophetic fields certainly are open to interpretation. A lot of Nostradamus is open to interpretation. But there are also things that have been documented that have not been caught in those mind projection. What I see in the cloud is what really is there. I see a giraffe, and my colleague over here sees an elephant, but I write a whole book about the giraffe rather than the elephant. There's a lot of that going on right now with 2012, and it's one of the reasons why I feel now, and I'm currently writing an e-book that's going to be an expose on a lot of the hysteria about 2012, and to try to get the context of what 2012 is in the bigger context of cyclic changing prophecy, put it in its proper place, and not have it kind of standing there with a lamp on its head in a party, but getting it back into the fact that we are definitely undergoing a lot of cyclic changes that are not going to happen in some instant time with some beam from the blue from the center of the galaxy, as some people are trying to project, or some Pollyanna consciousness lifting that is going to happen in 2012. These things are gradual. Even when history quickens, it's gradual. Seasons don't, you don't look at the solstice on December 21st and then clock it at midnight and then the snow starts falling and winter just comes just like that. It takes time. And even the seasons take their time to change, just like the seasons of history.
All right, Terry, thank you for the call. And I know you had another question. However, we have to move along. Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Stefan from Quebec City, Kevin.
Hello, Stefan.
Hello. Hello, Mr. Hogue. How are you?
Hello, Stefan.
Yeah, I was just looking on your website in the categories section, and there doesn't seem to be any sort of category dedicated to UFOs or extraterrestrials. Did Nostradamus talk about that at all, or did he just not give it any credence?
Well, actually, he gave it a lot of credence, and if you read Nostradamus' Complete Prophecies, and also, the whole, there are so many things to talk about in the world that my blog space has not yet had me write about the UFO angle, but I have in my stock of blogs that I had to write so that I could make some time to write my next ebook. I have some very interesting UFO prophecies coming, so I'm going to at last refresh that issue again, which I talked about in detail back in 1997 when I produced for HarperCollins, or for Element Books, Nostradamus, The Complete Prophecies, which is the... there's only been two people in the last 200 years that have written a full translation of Nostradamus' Complete Prophecies. One was Edgar Leone in 1961, the other was me in 1997. And I'm also working on upgrading that in the next few years and bringing forth a lot of interesting prophecies that could allude to the history of human beings in space. I mean, one of the most amazing prophecies of Nostradamus is his description of the real end of the world, according to him, which is the year 3797, not 2012. As when the sun expands to the orbit of Earth and burns it up. But he talks about that the races of humanity will survive this and have somewhat already left to live in Aquarius and in Cancer for a time immemorial. And the way he uses the syntax of his French, this is the first time that these astrological signs become places. So he's talking about us living in the stars. and that the end of the world is the physical world is though unfortunate, is not the end of the history of the human race.
Well, that's fascinating. So in between now and that point, does he talk about disclosure or contact?
Well, you know, there are when one looks at his use of the word monstre, which is where we get the word monster, it also means an omen, a divine omen. It means a transmission from some alien force like an angel or an angelic person. He talks about these dog-faced people, which is very intriguing, and which makes me wonder if there's some connection to the theories of the Sirius theories of the star, the dog star, the temple's idea about the East African people who actually foresaw that Sirius has three stars.
All right, we have to step away for a break. We'll be back, folks, right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, John Hoag. We are on final approach. That means we have time for maybe one more call. We have a flash message out of Australia. I'm sorry, that's not correct. It's out of the United Kingdom from Stephen in the United Kingdom. And John, he says, I just wanted to point out that apocalypse actually means the unveiling or the revealing and does not refer to doom and gloom. Also, there is video evidence of a Mayan elder who claims his family has been responsible for passing down knowledge concerning 2012. He says that their prophecy claims that 2010 is the return of the men of wisdom. Is 2012 the return of the gods? What do you think about that, John?
In the book I'm writing now about looking at 2012, there are not one but several people making these claims that need to be looked at with fresh eyes. And it's a little complicated to do on a show, but there are some very sincere shamans in the Mayan culture that have been pretty much taken up by the imaginations of people who have created this more expansive, rather fantastic view of 2012. And so, but there are also other elders who are not induced to go beyond the tradition. So definitely that's one thing that I'm going to examine in the book. The other, what was the other part of his question?
Well, he says that this particular Mayan elder says that the Mayan prophecy claims that 2010 is the return of the men of wisdom, and then he asks, is 2012 the return of the gods?
I think 2012, if I'll put it in another metaphorical way, if consciousness is God, then it just so happens that in this period of cyclic change, which the Mayans were so specific mathematically about, and other traditions less specific because they saw it as a longer period of change, what could be stated is that if consciousness is godliness, then the time when human beings act unconsciously on the planet has really, give or take 2012, 2011, 2013, or the 2020s, we're coming to a point where we have to be more conscious and not follow the patterns and habits and the de-educational systems that have created a human race that repeats the past and calls it the future and keeps the misery-go-round going. We could get away with our wars and our exploiting of the earth and our illusion that consuming can go on and expand and grow forever, and we can grow and breed as many people as we can forever, and the earth would always sustain it. The Ganges would always take our trash and remain pure, etc., etc. But that critical mass is coming around this time of cyclic change, expressed more specifically by 2012, but certainly not isolated to that year or time window, that are basically saying if God is going to come, or the gods are going to come to Earth, we have to be those gods. If my heart isn't open, how can God feel? If my eyes are blind to truth and reality, how will God be able to see through them and make a better world? This hand, our hands are the instruments of godliness. Our brains, when they are the servants of our souls, are the servants. This is an idea that is spoken of in prophecies that I generally put under the category of prophecies for the new humanity, which I talked about in the Millennium Book's prophecy, as well as in Messiahs, the visions and predictions of the Second Coming, which are also at hogprophecy.com, that describe a new take on messianic prophecies. There are almost 37 traditions out there that are all expecting their second coming, not just Jesus, but the second coming of all kinds of messiahs. And I think that relates indirectly to this idea that even the Maya feel of the coming of Pahana, the coming of the white brother to Turtle Island, which is the realm of the American Indian world. That idea is that the red brother and the white brother will come together and find a balance that will create the fifth world, which is the process we're going through right now, which the Maya are describing, as well as the Hopi and many other Native American traditions. A purification by fire, which can be either the fire of global warming, wars, droughts, wars over 120 wars over water rights, or it can be the fire of consciousness burning all the garbage that has become our traditions from the past cycle, which the past world, the fourth world. The Hopis as well as the Maya believe in the world being reborn, or the world of man's consciousness being reborn four times already. And now, just like the Buddhist wheel of Dharma has to be pushed for a new spin, this period is a period where the world as we know and as we are it needs to take a new birth. And it, in general, the idea is those who do not wish to make this change are going to be guided by their fear, and by their fear be destroyed. But those who can embrace the unknown and be open to the new, can adapt to the evolutionary crisis that has come to us, the future is blessed for them. And these times, though uncomfortable and unpredictable, are exciting for those challenged to change. Which brings me back to the final line of the 1999 prophecy, which is in a code. It said, before and after, Mars rules happily. Well, Mars in predictive astrology has two dimensions. It's the Mars, the god of war, or it's the Mars, the god of enterprise, of innovation, of exploration, of healing and enlightenment. Those are the higher aspects of Mars in symbolic astrology. And the fact that Nostradamus uses the riddle before and after makes me think that we have a choice to change our baser understanding of martial energy and the warrior spirit to something higher that will actually make us explorers and innovators and willing to take risks to make a better world.
All right. Well, John, I tell you, this has been a fascinating show. It always is when you're with us. And I want to thank you for taking the time to be with us this evening. And let me say to the audience, as always, when we have the URL for our guest website, we link their picture on my website. We link it to their website. It is so. And so if you will click on John's photograph, on his picture that's on my website, It will take you to his website, and you will find a true treasure trove of information along the lines that we've been talking about here tonight at his website. For those of you who are listening via AM, FM, or shortwave, and you're not in front of your computer, you can't click on his picture. So give us very quickly your web address again, John.
My web address is hogeprophecy.com. That's one word, that's hogeprophecy.com.
Outstanding. Again, John, thanks for being with us. If you will, stay on the line with me for a moment as we bring tonight's show to a close. Tomorrow night, folks, we are going to be open line. We've got a lot of good stuff that we're going to talk about, and then we'll open up the telephone lines where you can bring your own topic. One of the things that I've got for you tomorrow night is a free gift. You will only be able to download this during the show. Okay, so you have to be here during the show to be able to download this free gift. And it's something I think you will find very, very interesting. So I hope you'll be here. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. And you can call me whatever you want to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time. So long, everybody.